Hello, this is Belinda Rhodes with Guardian Daily on Wednesday, December the 24th, Christmas Eve. Today, animal rights activists convicted after a long campaign of intimidation.
It involved people in masks turning up in the middle of the night and daubing their houses with slogans or posting hoax bombs through the letterbox.
In his traditional end-of-year speech, the Pope makes a plea for the protection of heterosexuality. But just why did he compare it to saving the planet?
Of course, you can understand that gay rights groups all over the world have reacted very angrily. They've been very dismayed by this as well.
And for some victims of the floods of the summer of 2007, facing a second Christmas away from home, the memories just won't fade.
Little canoes canoeing down there, so you can imagine we was trying to stop water coming into the house, but it was practically impossible, although after a week or so the water had subsided.
But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers.
Animal rights extremists are still targeting labs despite a huge police operation which yesterday put key extremists behind bars. A campaign of threats and intimidation is continuing against scores of companies linked to controversial research at Huntington Life Sciences. Four leading activists have now been convicted following 6 years of blackmail. Three others pleaded guilty before the trial. They now face up to 14 years in prison when they're sentenced next month. But police sources have admitted to The Guardian these campaigns will never go away. There's more on this in just a moment. A report says Barack Obama had no corrupt contact with Illinois' scandal-tainted governor. An internal review has found the president-elect's staff did have half a dozen conversations with the office of Rod Blagojevich, but was not aware of efforts to sell off Obama's old Senate seat. But the five-page document is unlikely to lay to rest the scandal that has overshadowed the presidential transition. Governor Blagojevich, who has refused to step down, has been the subject of a number of corruption investigations since 2005. Britain is in the grip of a flu outbreak greater than anything seen in the last 8 years. New figures from the Royal College of GPs show soaring numbers of people falling ill. This week, there have been 69 cases in every 100,000 people. 2 weeks ago, that number was 28, less than half. This will cause problems for the health service over the Christmas break, especially combined with the spread of the vomiting bug norovirus. The last big flu outbreak occurred in 1999 to 2000, when 22,000 people died. The controversy over the arrest of Tory frontbencher Damian Green has taken a new twist. It's now emerged police officers had been wearing sound recording equipment at the time. Police arrested and held Shadow Immigration Minister Green for 9 hours last month in connection with a Home Office leak inquiry. In a statement, the Met admits a tape recording of Green's arrest was made without his knowledge and that the issue had now been referred to the UK's covert surveillance watchdog. Green's arrest and the subsequent search of his offices in the House of Parliament have provoked a furious exchange between the Conservative Party and police. The Queen's Christmas message will make reference to the global economic downturn. The monarch will also pay tribute to those who have led unselfish lives in the service of others. Her annual address on Christmas Day will also feature previously unseen home movie footage of a young Princess Elizabeth playing with Charles, aged just one, at Clarence House in 1949. The broadcast is one of the rare occasions when the monarch does not turn to the government for advice and is able to voice her own views. A quick look at this morning's papers. Most won't print for a few days now. The Times says hundreds of children who suffered neglect or abuse at the hands of their parents have been given the go-ahead to sue councils for damages. Spot fines for drivers involved in minor accidents is the lead in the Telegraph. The government plans to get tough on careless drivers with fines of £60 and 3 points on their licence. The Independent reports on how millions are going to be stranded in what it calls a trains fiasco. The rail industry, the government and regulators are playing a blame game over who is responsible for Britain's annual 58-hour Christmas railway shutdown. And some Christmas cheer from the Express now, as it says gas and electricity is to be 30% cheaper next year. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Four animal rights activists have been found guilty of blackmail after a campaign to intimidate firms that had connections with Huntington Life Sciences, as well as their employees and families. The tactics used by supporters of Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty were in some cases so severe that firms connected with the Animal Research Laboratory felt they had no option but to cut all ties with it. Our reporter Sandra Laville told me more about the wide range of tactics used by the group.
Well, the activists essentially wanted to blackmail anyone who had any links with Huntingdon Life Sciences. So they drew up a hit list of thousands of companies that were linked to them. Either they delivered their mail or they were pharmaceutical companies who benefited from their research. They identified employees and their home addresses, and they would post these company names and the individuals' names on their website and invite their supporters to pass the message to them that they should sever all links with the company. This would involve individuals being subjected to a campaign of terror at their homes, and it involved people in masks turning up in the middle of the night and daubing their houses with slogans or posting hoax bombs through the letterbox, or telling their neighbours that the individual involved was a paedophile and should not be allowed near children.
Was this done in the way that they invited supporters to do it? Was that to sort of deflect the blame from the activists themselves?
I think essentially they were quite clever legally. I mean, in fact, the fact they've been charged with conspiracy to blackmail and not hoax arson attacks or that kind of charge, it shows how clever they were, that they did try and distance themselves. They essentially organised it.
And they had a headquarters in a cottage in Hampshire, which was bugged by the police. So tell us a bit more about how the police gathered their evidence.
Well, the police realised that the only way they would get evidence was by using audio surveillance, and they went through all the various avenues and passed the test, the quite high test, to have that approved at the highest levels. And they put, it wasn't a bug, it was sort of audio surveillance in their cottage in Evesley in Hampshire, which is near Hook, and essentially listened to the meetings of the seven key figures and used that evidence along with encrypted emails, which they de-encrypted, and spreadsheets which were on the computer. And using that jigsaw, they pieced together the companies and how they were targeted and when they were targeted.
What can the four that were convicted expect in terms of sentencing?
The seven of them, effectively, because the three that pleaded guilty will receive similar sentences. Conspiracy to blackmail is considered a very serious charge, so they will, the ringleaders of the seven will probably have lengthy prison sentences, up to 10 years, perhaps.
Sandra Laville there, and you can find more on that story at guardian.co.uk/UK. Pope Benedict's traditional end-of-year speech has stirred up an unusual amount of controversy. In it, he called on the Church to protect humankind from self-destruction. What he was talking about was not obesity, smoking, or illegal drugs, but homosexuality, which the Vatican regards as a deviation or an irregularity. The Pope spoke about the need to protect what he called the order set down by creation, and compared it in importance to saving the rainforests. Gay rights groups have reacted angrily, calling the Pope's comments an unfounded attack on homosexuality. I asked our religious affairs correspondent, Riazat Bhatt, why she thought Benedict chose to talk about the issue in these unusual terms.
I would love to be able to give you the answer, but I think even the most dyed-in-the-wool Vatican watcher won't be able to shed light on what he really meant. He's an academic, he's a theologian, he's not used to giving sound bites. He tends to think out loud, much like the Archbishop of Canterbury, and doesn't always realise how his words are going to be interpreted. I think his Regensburg address is a key example of that. So people are saying that homosexuals need to be saved like the rainforest. Some people are saying that the rainforest, I don't know, it's all very confusing, and nobody's really been able to come up with a concise reason as to why he chose this particular metaphor.
And what about this end of year speech? What's the significance of it?
Well, it's obviously very high profile. Every time he says, he makes a public statement, there's always a great deal of attention paid to it. Some gay rights groups have been saying that there's a particular significance. It's coming up to Christmas. It's a public announcement. This is seen as a public shift towards a more hardline approach to homosexuality, but I don't think that's the case. I honestly don't think he meant to say what everybody seems to think he's saying.
But he isn't any more, certainly isn't any softer on homosexuality than any of his predecessors.
Well, homosexuality itself is not a sin. It's homosexual acts that are considered sinful. So really, and technically, the Vatican can't condemn homosexuality. he wouldn't be saying anything different from John Paul II, and he certainly wouldn't be going any further to the right, even though, again, liberals and gay rights campaigners may feel differently.
What have gay rights campaigners been saying about this speech?
Well, this is one of those stories where nobody's really clear exactly what was said, because, of course, it was translated and it appeared on a right-wing Catholic news service called Zenit. But obviously the easiest interpretation has been that gays are a threat to mankind. So, of course, you can understand that gay rights groups all over the world have reacted very angrily. They've been very dismayed by this as well. And I think in England and Wales, people will be concerned that any kind of pastoral work that they've been trying to do will be hindered by this. Not so long ago, they put out a leaflet saying that they should be more respectful and compassionate towards gays and lesbians in their flocks.
So gay rights groups are concerned about the ammunition that this might give to anti-gay campaigners.
I think there's plenty of ammunition against homosexuals in the church anyway. But I think this is a take it or leave it thing. I think what Christian gay movements will be trying to do is say to Catholics, hang on in there. He's completely wrong about homosexuality. It's not abnormal. It's perfectly normal. It's just like being left-handed. This man says lots of other things that are good that you should pay attention to, but on this thing, he's completely wrong.
And that was religious affairs correspondent Riazat Butt. While most British retailers are grimly complaining about the lack of Christmas custom, stores in one town in Northern Ireland are reporting better sales than last year. Shops in the city of Newry, once on the front line of the Troubles, are drawing huge amounts of custom from the Irish Republic, as shoppers from there find that their euros are going further than they used to. Pleas from Dublin to shop at home are being ignored, and queues at the border can be miles long. Henry MacDonald reports from Newry.
We have seen quite a large influx of southern shoppers, but this 2.5% reduction in VAT will also encourage more people to come to Newry to do shopping.
Because the VAT is lower than it would be in the Republic?
Oh, absolutely. Coupled with the fact that the euro exchange rate is quite beneficial for the southern shoppers to come up to Newry and make substantial savings on groceries, electronic goods, you name it.
I'm standing here in the entrance to the Keys shopping centre in Newry, along by the Newry Canal. Just looking across the car park, which is full of Southern Irish Republic registered cars. In fact, they're the majority of the vehicles in that car park. And I'm looking across to a store called Toys Store, and it says out the window that for your euro, you will get a pound. And that is obviously hooking people in to buy toys for Christmas. Newry is bucking the trend of other cities in the UK. It is right on the border. It's perfectly positioned to suck in trade from the Irish Republic, given that everything seems to be cheaper these days in Northern Ireland as opposed to down south. Came all the way from Dublin?
We did, yeah. How much cheaper?
How much are you saving?
Easily over half price, like easily. On a week, you'd around 50, 60 pounds, even 100 euros you'd be saving, for definite.
Is that just for weekly shop versus the Christmas shop?
No, it's just really weekly shop. But weekly shop, all the detergents and all that, you'd be saving around 50 euros.
We're also about to go into the Jack and Jones store here inside the Keys shopping centre on Newry's Canal. And we're going to speak to Suzanne Burns, who's the manager of this store, about why they're putting a pound for a euro on their window signs.
It is, of course. We started last Thursday and we were supposed to finish it on Sunday past, but we're keeping it going now because it is business booming at the minute.
And presumably that's all Southern business?
Of course, yes. All Southerners. Mondays and Tuesdays are particularly busy, which you wouldn't think. But yes, Southerners all day, every day coming through the doors.
And what are they looking for? What sort of band stuff for teenagers and that?
Just all men's wear we do, so everything's flying out at the minute.
So they like this exchange rate?
Yes, of course, yeah. So, but we're also giving -15% on the sterling rate to everybody. Rather than people going to the bureaus and changing, we're discounting the sterling rate as well, so everybody benefits from it.
So you can just take your euros, you don't need to change them. You just come with your euro and it's a pound.
If you're coming with sterling, we give a good rate on the sterling as well. They're -15% in it as well. Then the footfall in the Keys alone, I would say, is amazing. Coming down Dublin Road is just crazy every day at the minute.
And you're saying that's even better than last year when people had money in their pockets and we didn't have a credit crunch?
Well, yeah. Particularly now with the euros.
And that was Henry MacDonald reporting from Newry in Northern Ireland. I'm Belinda Rhodes. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come in today's programme, one of the country's most celebrated choirs looks for new blood through an apprenticeship scheme.
I love it. I do. It's such a fantastic experience, and I'm still at the stage where I'm very much head in jazz and kind of finding new things, and I couldn't think of a better way of finding my way through the classical world.
But first, the floods in the north of England in the summer of 2007 are just a distant memory for most of us, but some families there are about to spend their second Christmas away from home or only using part of their homes. Many houses are still uninhabitable because of water damage, while secondary flooding or rising damp has caused further setbacks, and many people are still waiting for full payment from insurers. The Guardian's North of England editor, Martin Wainwright, went to Hull to investigate.
I'm in Hull with Charlene Kent, who was one of the many, many victims in this city of the great floods in the summer of 2007, June 2007. And there's still a handful of people in the city not yet back home, and they're facing their second Christmas in caravans or out of their houses, staying with other people or in temporary accommodation. Charlene is back, but you've been through an awful lot, and you were just describing to me what happened that day in June.
Kind of my first instincts were to go out and pick my daughter up from school because we knew it wasn't kind of just a shower.
And by the time you got to the school?
Yes, it was flooded, and we had to carry the children out of the school. And carry them. We couldn't take them home because we knew all properties would have been flooded, kind of, because we lived right near the school at the time. So we had to take her to grandma and granddad's.
I think some people get the idea of a flood, you know, a big wall of water coming into the house, but it isn't like that, is it? It's kind of just sinister and slow.
Yes, it's, you know, I live on an end terrace with a driveway, and it was just kind of filling up, and you see it rising like a bath, if you like, and it's kind of filling up and then checking under our floors, and it was rising, and it was rising, and yeah, not nice.
I've come to Malcolm Cook's house in Willoughby Road, which you can spot from far away because there's still a caravan and a portaloo in the front garden. And you're partly in there, but you're partly upstairs as well, Malcolm.
Yes, that's right, yes. Upstairs and in the caravan, yes. When it gets a bit too noisy, it's a case for me to go in the caravan.
Yeah, it's a bit like the old shed at the bottom of the garden.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Get out the way.
And this is your second Christmas like this?
This will be the second Christmas, yeah.
What happened back in June 2007?
Well, the old place was just completely flooded. It just started raining and it just kept on coming and coming. It just got worse. The drains couldn't take it. The old, from the top of Willoughby Road, right the way down the road, it was just completely flooded. There was people, to be quite honest with, there was in little canoes canoeing down there, so you can imagine we was trying to stop water coming into the house, but it was practically impossible. Although after a week or so the water had subsided, and the found out that the house started to smell. With all the...
Because you'd had all the filthy stuff in here.
Everything was floating from one end of the street to the other. The back way was flooded. It was a bit of a mess, to be quite honest with you.
And are there many of you? I mean, people talking about there being 100 or so still in your situation with, you know, partly in caravan.
I dare say there's a lot more people don't realise, and they're going to realise very shortly, that some of the houses have got to be redone again. Because
of this secondary flooding.
Secondary flooding, you see, and there's a lot of people don't realise what they've got yet at the moment, and they may find out maybe in a week or two or a month or two's time, or 6 weeks or two, 6 years, well, 6 months' time, I should say, that this is going to happen. And I think it was reported in Hull sometime during the week that there's some of the houses here that they're finding that they've had it done and it's going to have to be all redone again.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The traditional image of an apprenticeship is of a young man wearing an overall and holding a spanner. But today there's a much wider range of apprenticeships available, including one with the world-renowned Monteverdi Choir. Through it, young singers learn on the job from older mentors. At the end of the year, if an apprentice fits and there's a vacancy in the choir, they're invited to join. Much like an apprentice in Arsenal's books, getting a place in the first team. Sir John Eliot Gardner, one of the world's most celebrated composers, is behind the scheme to help trained singers find their way.
You've suddenly been sort of disgorged out of university or conservatoire, and you're suddenly left without a grant or any sort of public finance to make your way in the world. And you've been trained to be a singer, but you know, what do? You join a church choir, you might get a salary if you're lucky. You audition for lots of different choirs, chamber choirs, and you gradually network your way into the music profession. It can go awfully wrong.
This is actually the second year that the Monteverdi Choir has run an apprenticeship scheme, and the eight singers chosen after audition are into their third month of it. But the basic principle of the programme, or of any apprenticeship, of learning a craft on the job under the guidance of an older hand, goes much further back.
What has always been a strand in the Monteverdi Choir since we started in 1964 has been the sense in which there have been lead singers who got a bit more experience and who are often doing the solos, who impart their knowledge to the younger singers, very much on the model of how it used to be in Bach's day and in the Cantorei tradition in Germany, but also what still carries on to some extent in collegiate choirs in this country. But to formalise it in a way that gives the singers that we've chosen a kind of rather privileged existence for a year when they're not actually, they're in sort of limbo because they haven't actually committed themselves yet to the music profession, and yet they're experiencing all the complications and excitements and the pitfalls, I may say, of the music profession in a privileged environment for a year, so that we look after them.
Most of the apprentices in these first 2 years have been Oxbridge choral scholars, but, says Sir John Eric Gardner, this has not been a deliberate policy. It's just that these two universities offer their singers a more comprehensive training, he says. This year's crop has five sopranos, one contralto, one countertenor, and a bass. Chloe Morgan, who's 22, is the contralto.
I was on the jazz course at Trinity College of Music. I've come from a conservatoire. I'm, in fact, the only one who's not Oxbridge, which is fun.
How are you finding it?
I love it. I do. It's such a fantastic experience, and I'm still at the stage where I'm very much ahead in jazz and kind of finding new things, and I couldn't think of a better way of finding my way through the classical world.
So, learning on the job rather than in the conservatoire practice room. How does that suit the bass apprentice? Until recently, 22-year-old Christopher Borrett was singing in the choir at New College, Oxford, itself no mean ensemble. Are you enjoying it? Is it teaching you something?
Oh yes, every rehearsal is something new. I mean, I came from university thinking, actually, I've had one of the best choir masters in the world, and everything's good. So I'm on top of my game. Come here, it's a totally different ball game, totally different perspectives. Everything is, as there's many new things as there are things that I thought I knew already. So everything's highly educational, and yeah, very much so. It's very stimulating.
The government wants to expand the numbers of apprentices massively across the country. Does Sir John Eliot Gardner see his scheme as part of this national growth?
Well, I suppose tangentially, yes. I wasn't particularly aware of the government making that initiative, but I wish they'd support us because we have absolutely no government support at all towards the costs of our music making and the educational work we do or the concerts we do, and we're skint, and it would be very helpful if there was some support.
Singers of the Monteverdi Choir there, and speaking to them was Peter Kingston, The Guardian's further education correspondent. And that's all from Guardian Daily today. The producers today were Andy Duckworth and Peter Sale. I'm Belinda Rhodes, thank you for listening. And that's our last scheduled Guardian Daily until January 5th. So from the team here, a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.